Welcome to the Biz News Briefing. I'm Alec Hogg, and today is Tuesday, the 29th of July. Well, big news today here in South Africa is that Bain & Company, the bane of our lives, the business, the consulting business that tried to destroy South African Revenue Services, has finally thrown in the towel and left the country. This after pressure was mounting due to the fact that Bain had been used in the G20 and the B20, the business arm of the G20. But it's been building for quite some time. The story was broken today by our partners at the Financial Times of London, who essentially explained how Bain had done some very dirty things in South Africa. And indeed, it's now turned its Johannesburg operation essentially into a back office. It won't be selling anymore. South Africans did not like what Bain had done, and South Africans, both in the public and the private sector, were not doing business with Bain. So they've finally given up the ghost. It is interesting to note that South African-born British politician Lord Peter Hain had been successful in getting Bain out of the British government for a period of time anyway in 2022, but they won it on a court action and managed to have that ruling set aside. It was a 10-year ruling that Bain could not do business with the British government over that period. Well, they got back, but earlier this year, the Labour Party said or left public in no doubt about its view on this company by saying that if it had a legal way of being able to block it, it certainly would have done so. In the article this morning from the Financial Times of London, it references the Zondo Commission, which in 2022 said that the Bain & Company was one of the few instances in which President Jacob Zuma, now the head of the MK Party, was himself directly and personally involved in the activities and plans to take over a government entity, that government entity being the one at the center of our lives, the tax authority, South African Revenue Services, which has been successfully rebuilt in the period since. This is not the first time that the Financial Times has waved a flag about Bain. It had a very strong editorial in 2022. It came out shortly after the Zondo Commission calling it Bain's cautionary South African tale, and it actually urged the company to apologize and do more than just try to bat away the issues. Well, Bain & Company has attempted to bat away things, and it was unsuccessful. The company leaving South Africa finally today. Moving on to other stories of the moment. Well, Trollope and O'Sullivan are going at it, a South African and an Irishman. I spoke yesterday with Athol Trollope. The reason why he and Paul O'Sullivan are coming to legal blows, and Athol Trollope, who's the parliamentary leader of Action SA, has laid a criminal charge against Paul O'Sullivan, is because of the way they have been discussing or talking publicly about Lieutenant General Nhlanhla Mkhwanazi's bombshell disclosures. O'Sullivan believes Mkhwanazi is the biggest crook of them all. Athol Trollope thinks differently. Let's have a listen to a highlight of the interview that you'll find on BizNews.
I wrote to my attorney over the weekend, and I sent him O'Sullivan's intemperate messages, and I'll tell you what he said. He said the following: "Good morning. In my view, the message received is vicious and amounts to inuria and possible extortion. If published by the author, it will result in defamation and substantial damages. A cautionary lawyer's letter would be appropriate for the author to cease and desist. Trust these answers to your query." Now, up until this morning, he had been communicating with me privately on WhatsApp, and it wasn't a public communication. As soon as he sent the email with all the same threats and allegations of criminality and the fact that we, me and Action SA support Mkhwanazi and his criminal activities, he then put it in the public domain because he sent it to Herman Mashaba, Michael Beaumont and Matthew George, who is our media manager. So that is a public document. That too is with the police. It's part of my complaint with the police that he had sent me threatening and intimidating WhatsApp messages and subsequently sent me a threatening and intimidating email. And he had sent it to various other people. So it's now a public document. So Paul O'Sullivan has really challenged me, and I'm up for the challenge. I believe I've done absolutely nothing wrong. I know what I tweeted. It's on the record. I know exactly what I tweeted, and I said that his information and allegations must be tested, as must Mkhwanazi's. But I went further to say, who appointed him as the minister or police commissioner at large or the spokesperson for SAPS? Because I know that he holds no formal position in the South African police services. And I've often wondered about, I've heard him even at a business news conference where he says he's going after people. He says it in my communication. He says, I'm going to go after you and I'm going to get you. As soon as I've got Masemola, as soon as I've got Mkhwanazi, I'm going to get you. Stop me if you can. Typical Paul O'Sullivan. It's exactly what he says always. And he said it to me. And I think that he's barking up the wrong tree here.
His record is very strong. He's the only person that we know anywhere in the world who's managed to get two police commissioners out of office. Is there not just a slight concern in your mind that maybe he's right about Mkhwanazi and that Mkhwanazi is not the angel that he appears to have been painted?
Alec, I want to make it perfectly clear. Nowhere in my statements or in the Action SA statements do we take Mkhwanazi's part. Nowhere. All I said is that the allegations he has made have to be taken seriously, as do the allegations made by O'Sullivan himself. I've never taken Mkhwanazi's side. I will not take Mkhwanazi's side. Why would I do that before the outcomes of a special commission of inquiry? I would never, ever do that. I'm not stupid. He happens to think I'm stupid. He calls me stupid. He calls me ignorant and calls me a criminal. That's fine. Those are his opinions. I know that I'm none of those, but I have never supported Mkhwanazi. Yes, our Action SA representatives at the time from KwaZulu-Natal went to the police headquarters to say that Mkhwanazi must not be made a scapegoat and he must not be threatened or taken out of the police services because he's made these allegations. That was their conviction. Our activists from KZN, they were at the police station in KZN. I never said anything about Mkhwanazi. And I think that is what's got Paul O'Sullivan hot under the collar and barking up the wrong tree. But he's barked up that tree now and he must deal with his actions.
Mm. Well, the General Mkhwanazi's bombshell disclosures still continue to reverberate. There is a commission of inquiry and Paul O'Sullivan is saying he's not going to be releasing anything of substance until then. However, we will be talking to him next week to get his right of reply to Athol Trollope. Earlier this morning, I spoke with the two gents who are in a million rand showdown. A member of the BizNews tribe decided that he was tired of this local versus offshore investment debate. He gave half a million rand to Piet Viljoen and half a million rand to Magnus Haystack and said to the two of them, just have a go over the next 5 years and we'll see who truly is the better, local or offshore. Magnus, of course, being very much pro the international investments. We certainly was in the past, and Piet Viljoen has been recommending local investments, not for the reasons you would anticipate. So go and watch that full recording of the discussion. But the part that I'm going to play for you now is where I asked them about the recent strength of the South African rand. This is an issue that I've certainly been asked many times by people that I bump into at various social occasions. Let's have a listen to what Magnus thinks first, and then Piet's view.
The rand is determined by global economic forces. You know, the the events in South Africa, the political events in South Africa, if you ask the average man 5 years ago, guys, this is what's going to happen. Expropriation without compensation, the Bella Act, we're going to do this. People would have said the Rand will be 20 by 2025. Now, that has not happened, mainly because of the decline in the dollar. The dollar has been declining very aggressively against the euro, pound, euro. In fact, it's one of the sharpest declines over the last 20 years. So the Rand is being helped, and also the country has been helped tremendously by the weaker dollar, the much weaker dollar. And that, I can't predict what's going to happen in the next 18 months. There's all kinds of talk that you need to prepare yourself for that. And that could mean a stronger rand and weaker oil prices and lower inflation for South Africa, which would be good for South Africa.
Sorry, you broke up at the critical moment there. You said there's talk about, and then we lost you. What exactly is it talking about?
Goldman Sachs again this morning, and he's not been warning that it could be a pivotal time for the dollar versus other currencies. In other words, the dollar dominance is coming to an end. Now, that's the billion dollar question. Is it the case, or is it part of a cycle? That I don't know, and I don't know anybody knows.
Pete, the Rand and its relative strength, before you give us your strategy for the next 16 months?
Yeah, so I think what Martin's pointing out is right, is that there is talk now that the dollar dominance is coming to an end, and one can understand why. If you look at the finances of the US, which are not in great shape, and in fact, the finances of most developed markets are not in great shape. And I think I've been saying this for a while. I mean, debt ratios are out of control, government spending is out of control, and developed markets are, for me, almost the new emerging markets in terms of how they are managing their finances. So I think there's significant risk along that vector there. And if that happens, if developed markets start acting like the emerging markets of old, then you can see significant weakness globally in the US dollar, and that would translate into rand strength, not because we have such a great economy or such a great system, but just because the dollar is weak. And that's actually what's been happening over the past while.
So are you expecting it to continue?
I have no idea, Alec. If I look at the finances of the US, it doesn't bode well for the dollar. But I do think that betting against the U.S. has not been a winning strategy for a very long time. So I'd be loath to put all my eggs in one basket. But I think as one manages your finances, you tilt it away from the dollar and towards other assets.
Cody from Paul has sold multiple vehicles to We Buy Cars. Suspicious?
I think so.
Is that a crime?
No. Where are you getting the cars?
I buy them and I sell them at the spot, like a normal person.
Okay.
No, man, I'm just an accounting student. I know a good deal when I see one.
That's Excel. Meant. What's more stressful, tax season or selling a car at We Buy Cars?
Tax season, obviously.
We Buy Cars, the easiest way to sell your car by far.
My colleague Chris Stain had a conversation yesterday with Sarah Berger. Sarah is the Fort Hare investigator, you might recall, who was brought in to have a look at malfeasance at the university and then ended up getting arrested herself. She does leave a little spot, or all of this leaves a little spot on the halo of Mkhwanazi, because it was his operation, General Nhlanhla Mkhwanazi's operation, which actually did the arrest in the first place. Anyway, she has been cleared and all charges against her dropped, as they should never have been brought in the first place. But when Chris spoke with her, she said, this isn't the end of the story by any means.
We've already laid a complaint against the police and the conduct throughout the 17 months. That included gross intimidation. I mean, everyone knows about the private jets. It wasn't just for us. It was for several other people. Then we had that a despicable restraint application brought on us with 22 policemen and 8 vans, for instance, just at Bradley's house. So complaints were then subsequently lodged about their conduct. When we appeared now, there were a what appeared to be national intervention units and task team members in court again, multiple with rifles the size of human bodies. I mean, scary looking stuff. And, you know, one wonders to yourself, what is the purpose of that? We're not dangerous people. We're just standing there. We've always been obedient and quiet and compliant and, you know, following the law as legal practitioners would. But you've got all these heavy balaclavas, stun grenades and guns around you. So in short, we have lodged 2 complaints each with the police portfolio committee. And I will be following up with that now and probably become like a chihuahua at the ankles of the chairperson of that committee, because I believe that this should be investigated. Insofar as the National Prosecuting Authority are concerned, complaints were already lodged with the NBPP's office, and there isn't an investigation that is underway already. So I won't speak about that, but I do believe that there will be an outcome, and we have already been interviewed as part of that investigative process. There are other role players too. I won't go into it now, but as I said previously, accountability is what is required in this process. You know, the police and the NPA hold very, very powerful positions over people's lives and freedom of movement. And when you are abused in a process like this, and as a legal practitioner looking at this unfolding and feeling completely powerless, you want to say to yourself, gee, what an abuse of that unlevel playing field. So I believe that it is important from an integrity point of view that these people come and answer at any committee, whether it's the ethics committee at the NPA or whether it's the police portfolio committee for the police and in the other platforms where I plan to lodge complaints as well.
Big news coming out of the international arena this morning is that the European Union and Donald Trump have gotten together and signed a deal. This was just a couple of days ahead of Friday's termination, or the day that the end of duty-free access for the EU to the United States would be over. He was threatening between 30 and 50% tariffs. A deal has been done. Interestingly enough, American goods are going to be going into Europe duty-free. European goods are going to go into America with a 15% duty. Now, this might confuse some people, unless you know or understand that Donald Trump and his band of merry men have been focusing a great deal on non-tariff barriers, and Europe has got plenty of them, as do we here in South Africa. What South Africa's status is, with 2 days to go before the 30% tariff, or perhaps is it 40% because of our 10% bonus being a BRICS member, before that kicks in, we don't yet know, but we can only live in hope. But let's catch up with our partners at the Financial Times of London, where Mark Filippino hosts the FT News Briefing, and they had a good look at the implications of the deal that Donald Trump struck with the European Union yesterday.
The EU and the US agreed to a trade deal over the weekend. It's going to hit most European imports with a 15% tariff. The deal also requires the bloc to invest hundreds of billions of euros into American energy products and weapons. I'm joined now by the FT's Alice Hancock to unpack this. She covers the EU. So how have markets reacted, and what does that tell you about how this deal might impact Europe's economy?
I think that quote you used from the EU Trade Commissioner about it avoiding an all-out trade war is the kind of damning with faint praise that sums up most of the reaction to this deal. Markets were up on the kind of relief of getting a deal, but then they, of course, fell back on Monday when everyone realized that that still meant that there would be a huge proportion of goods that were covered by a 15% tariff, as you said, for most goods. And that's obviously vastly more than the EU was paying before the Trump presidency.
So based on the quote and by the market reaction, I'm getting the sense that European politicians aren't super hot on the deal?
No, I can give you a little flavor from some of the leaders from near where I sit in Brussels. The Dutch prime minister said that no tariffs would have been better, obviously. And the Dutch prime minister said it might be a moment of relief, but it's certainly not one of celebration. The French prime minister said that the trade deal was an act of, quote, submission and described it as a dark day for Europe. And a former EU trade official, actually, who used to be very high up in the Directorate of Trade, just said that the EU had totally submitted itself to the US and had lost all its political power doing this.
So, Alice, despite the strong reaction, it's important to point out that this is just a handshake deal and much of the detail still needs to be hammered out. What are the main points that need to be decided?
Yeah, I was going to actually start by saying that I should probably caveat everything I say with the fact that we've seen nothing on paper yet. Yeah. So this is all just based on briefings from officials. And so there's this 15% on most goods that can include, as we understand it at the moment, semiconductors, pharmaceutical, cars. There is things like steel could be subject to a 50% rate indeed, depending on an agreed quota. And then there are other elements included in the deal, such as the EU promising to buy or invest in $750 billion worth of US energy products.
As you're speaking, I'm kind of getting the sense that this may have been done just to get something in under the wire, because the deadline is Friday, right? And who knows what would have happened had this not gotten completed before then.
Yeah, it's a good point. I mean, there have been hundreds of hours of negotiations since April, but of course, Trump keeps changing the goalposts. So there was definitely a feeling that when he was coming over to Scotland, they had to kind of get to this point because he wanted to have this deal done before his deadline. And there were points open during their negotiations on Sunday. But this is why I think that there are still so many gaps that have been left.
Right now, you can get the cheapest Forex rate around, right here, on Shift. Pay less for your dollars, pounds, and euros here, and get to shop more here, and do more here, and enjoy more ooh-la-la here. Shift also lets you trade and transfer currencies, and buy shares in the world's best companies. It all happens right here, on Shift. You won't find a cheaper Forex rate anywhere else, no matter where you bank. Download the Shift app today.
At Sun Exchange, we make going solar simple, profitable, and completely risk-free. Join over 100 satisfied South African customers already enjoying the benefits of risk-free solar. Start saving today. Visit sunexchange.com and join the solar revolution.
We're still with Donald Trump. He's now decided that with the EU settled, he's going to be taking Vladimir Putin on. Now, it's interesting. If you see things in isolation, they do look like they're unrelated. If you consider that the EU is desperate to get the American support in its defense against Russian aggression, particularly against Ukraine, and Donald Trump and the EU were negotiating yesterday. Nothing was said yesterday, of course. But now Donald Trump has cut back his original 50-day deadline to between 10 and 12 days for Putin to back off Ukraine or face the wrath of long-range American weapons. Things are curiouser and curiouser. Let's have a look with our partners at Bloomberg.
I'm going to make a new deadline of about 10 or 12 days from today. There's no reason in waiting. There's no reason in waiting. It's 50 days. I want to be generous, but we just don't see any progress being made.
Joining me now is Bloomberg's Adam Blanford. Well, this was supposed to be a 50-day window. Now Trump has reduced it to 10 to 12 days. You have to wonder whether these change in dates is arbitrary in terms of decision-making. But why has Trump issued this deadline to the Russian president? Why now?
Good morning, Jemana. As you say, a longer deadline was in the offing. I think it was just 2 weeks ago that Trump said he would issue a 50-day deadline and give Vladimir Putin 50 days to end the war in Ukraine. But, you know, looking at that clip there, the president looked perhaps pretty exasperated. Maybe he was in the middle of a long press conference, as you know, yesterday. But he changed his timeline after just 14 days. So now he's given Vladimir Putin a 2-week ultimatum to say stop the fighting. Really, it's because he's a man who wants to make deals, and he's found over the 6 or 7 months now that he's been in office that it's been very difficult to get Vladimir Putin to make a deal. He talked openly with Keir Starmer, the UK Prime Minister, mm-hmm. yesterday about how he would call Vladimir Putin. He would have good calls with the Russian president, talks about how they have a good relationship. But then at the end of the calls, when the calls are finished, as he says, Putin fires missiles into a city and hits a nursing home in Kyiv or another Ukrainian city. And, you know, he sounded exasperated with this. And he's a man, as we say, who wants to get things done. He's trying to do this in other places. Yeah. And he's finding it frustrating with Putin. So that's the surface level. And it seems to be he's shortening that deadline from September to now to the first to August again, another mm-hmm. couple of weeks.
Well, that's your briefing for today. Look forward to being back in your company again tomorrow. Until then, cheerio.